Beginning as Balducci's Fruit Stand in Greenwich Village 70 years ago, Baldor Specialty Foods has been curating and delivering the highest quality foods in the world to the restaurant and hospitality industries. Chefs rely on Baldor for the freshest and most seasonal ingredients, along with new and exciting items that you just can't get elsewhere. Baldor's ordering process is designed with a chef's schedule and priorities in mind to get you what you need when you need it. Baldor is the trusted resource and partner for the region's top chefs. Learn what Baldor can do for your business today at baldorfood.com.
Hi, this is Katie Kiefer from What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm Claudia Wu.
And I'm Carrie Diamond. You faked me out on that one, Claudia. And we're the founders of Cherry Bomb, the indie magazine about women and food. Well, it was a historic week for women, or an historic, depending on which you prefer. Unless something crazy happens, Hillary is going to be the Democratic Party's candidate for president, making her the first female presidential candidate for a major party. I know there are a lot of Bernie fans listening, and maybe we even have a few Trump fans. But this is a big deal, especially when you consider that women didn't even get the right to vote until 1920. Did everybody in the room know that? That's, you know, we haven't even been voting for 100 years. My great-grandmother couldn't vote. My grandmother's born women couldn't vote. So we've come a long way. So congratulations to Hillary. I'm sure this is not the first time or the last time we're going to be talking about Hillary on air. I'd kind of like to see a Hillary-Bernie ticket. I know that's magical thinking, but I don't know. What do you think, Claudia? You're not into politics.
No, not really. But I don't know if I could see that happen. Anyone else?
I know what you would be into, Claudia. I know what would get you to vote.
Cats on a ticket.
There's been a White House cat before. No, a Hillary Martha Stewart ticket.
Oh my God, I don't know. I don't know about that.
You would have to vote for that. So I think
an ex-con.
Come on. No, we love Martha. Martha would be amazing. That would be the best thing ever. Or as Martha likes to say,
it's a good thing.
It's a good thing. You know it. So, all right, we'll take a break from politics and thank our sponsors who make Radio Cherry Bomb possible.
Prince Street, the new fresh podcast with a culinary heart from Dean and DeLuca. Natural Gourmet Institute for Health and Culinary Arts, where you can start your journey to becoming a natural food chef today. And Baldor Specialty Foods, which curates and delivers the best and freshest food in the world to the restaurant and hospitality industries.
I hope everybody's been checking out the Prince Street podcast. It's really good. It's nice to hear all our friends on it, you know, all our friends. Who are all our friends? Eden's on there, Grinch Pan.
Sierra Tishkar.
Sierra's on there, Pavia Rosati. It's really great. The latest episode went live, I think, last week, and there's a terrific interview with the young entrepreneur behind this line of Somalian sauces. I think it's pronounced Boss Boss. But I don't want to give her story away because it's pretty heart-wrenching, but you should give it a listen. They're doing a great job with that podcast. And then speaking of Baldor, did everybody see Baldor's picture of the white strawberries that we posted on Instagram?
We posted a correction after that, though.
No, it wasn't a correction.
Pineberry?
I was like, has anybody seen these? And then somebody like explained what they were. So yeah, they're called pineberries and they taste like strawberry crossed with pineapple.
Huh, sounds delicious.
It sounds like something you would be super into.
Something that might be good for a cocktail.
Yes. Or I was thinking a smoothie, but yeah, a cocktail.
No, a cocktail.
Too. All right. Well, speaking of cocktails, our first guest is the bar director and partner of not one, not two, but four successful Manhattan bars, including Dear Irving, Rain's Law Room, and her newest spot, The Bennett, a new cocktail bar with a relaxed, glamorous feel. Though Megan has worked in music, fashion, and publishing in past lives, including at Rockefeller Records and Rockaware, it's her skill behind the bar that has earned her lots of accolades, including Best Bartender in New York. That is no small achievement. So, Megan Dorman, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thank you. Very excited to be here.
Yeah, we're super psyched that you're here. So, tell us, how does one get to be Best Bartender in New York City?
I don't know if it's in New York City, but in Vibe Magazine gave me a nice title this year of Bartender of the Year. So that's very exciting.
So they meant like best bartender in the world, obviously, right?
My mom would say so.
So tell us a little bit about you. Where are you from?
I'm from right outside of New Haven, Connecticut, so not far away. I've been in New York about 12 years since right after college. I was ready to get out of there, and now my dad makes fun of me. I spend a lot of time going back to the suburbs. But yeah, I've always, if you're from the Northeast, my first job was at Friendly's, making ice cream cakes. And then when you're 18 in Connecticut, you can serve alcohol. So my friend got me a job at her sports bar she was working at. I had a wonderful, wonderful boss, Susie Parker. So I worked there all through college, right up to, you know, football Sundays and Friday nights. So I was making good money in college. And it was something I went back to on and off when I was doing freelance work or assisting. And then I started drinking at bars, like mostly Little Branch was like my go-to spot. And then I just decided I wanted to go back to bartending full time and put down roots somewhere, and it's worked out so far.
You must have been making mad money in college.
For college, yeah.
Yeah. I was a sucker. I worked at bookstores.
Yeah.
I had no idea that if I could wait tables or bartend or something like that, I would have been pulling in way more money.
I did do the library for a while, and I was like, oh, no. Back to the bar.
What was it about the bar culture that you liked?
That it was different every day, that we had a really good crew of regulars at the New Haven bar I was at. So it was just interesting every day, and there was a real chance to like work your way up and see the difference in the money you made if, you know, you were really engaged at work and doing a good job.
Now, I'm guessing that was before the explosion. I mean, every industry is going through disruption right now, but what the cocktail industry has gone through in the past like 10, 15 years, just with the introduction of all the indie brands, cocktail culture becoming such a huge thing. Was that sort of starting when you were getting on and into the whole scene?
It was starting in New York. It definitely was not starting in New Haven. And I didn't really get any drink training. It was kind of by regulars' orders. It was like, you have to be able to make this margarita for this guy, and this guy is going to drink a whiskey sour. So it was like for people.
It was cheers.
Yeah. So it wasn't until I started going out drinking in New York that I really saw a different side of it.
Okay.
And now it's overwhelming. People are trying to sell us new stuff every day.
So what would you consider was your first pivotal job in the scene?
Really at Rain's Law Room. I mean, I worked at, you know, some restaurants that try to do cocktails, but looking back, it was like some real management issues why it wasn't working. But I really just went out a lot and I made drinks at home, and I made like office happy hour drinks with all the stuff that we got, and really was looking for a job that was more serious when Rain came along, and then it just worked out from there.
So tell me what makes a great bartender.
I think the most important thing about being a good bartender is being consistent. You have to be the same person at 5 p.m., at 2 a.m., so you can like deal with all those kinds of people that have, you know, now had various amounts of alcohol. Always being like walking the line of professional but friendly, and getting to know people, and being present enough at work that you can remember people, their names, what they drink, and not just let people go by you.
You know, it's so interesting you said that, because when I asked you that question, I was thinking more about the sort of the alchemy and the creative side of it. And I wasn't even thinking you've got this whole other side where you have to deal with personalities, people hitting on you, running out on their bar tabs. You know, you have to kind of be a human relations specialist.
Yeah, I would say that takes longer to be good at. You know, I have a good memory, which has always served me well bartending, but, you know, I can get specs and recipes down pretty quick and figure out the best way to make a drink or batch something out. But it's like years and years of dealing with humans that makes you a better bartender.
Wow. So it's not just about being a mixologist.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's fascinating. So, but we do want to talk about the mixology side of things. So what, are there any drinks that you're known for?
A few. I have a drink called the Wildest Redhead.
The Wildest Redhead.
Kind of named after my hair color, but also I found an old drink called a Wild Redhead in an old bar book, and it was just so boring, but the name was so good that it deserved a second life. So that's been on a lot of menus that we've, amongst the bars. Have a really fun drink.
Wait, go back. What's in a Wild Redhead?
Oh, sorry. Blended scotch, lemon, honey, allspice, and a little bit of cherry herring. Ooh. So the original was just lemon and cherry herring, which...
What's that last one?
Cherry herring.
I don't know
cherry-based liqueur. Okay. Not that exciting when it's just with lemon juice.
How hard is it to make a drink classic, you know? Like, you know, a gimlet or a martini? Are there any like recent drinks that have kind of become part of the bartending folklore?
The penicillin is probably the most famous one from Milk and Honey, which is like a smoky scotch sour with a little ginger. That's one that I think across the world now you could order.
Really?
But it takes a few years and a few people like putting it on their friend's menu or going to a different city and ordering it before it really gets legs.
Are there any drinks with like trademarks? Like you can't serve this drink?
Only the Dark and Stormy, which Gosling
that's
has
trademarked.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know how I feel about that.
Yeah, because I've heard they will, you know, if you print it on a menu without Gosling's, you could get yourself in some trouble.
Huh. Okay, who knew? So what are, continuing on what Claudia asked, what are people drinking these days?
People are drinking all kinds of things, which is really fun and lets us be really creative. And almost like food in New York, like someone will try it. You can make anything and someone will try it. It might not go over with everyone, but that's what's fun. Like people come in every day asking us what's new, what's it, like, what are we working on? They're willing to just try our little experiments, which we do with a lot of regulars, which lets us like work out the kinks because we're kind of hanging out with ourselves all the time. So people will almost try anything. You have shrub in that little spritzer that I made you, which is I really love right now, that mix of sweet and sour.
So tell everybody what we're about to drink.
So this is a strawberry letter, which I brought a little batch of from the Bennett. It's a nice afternoon drink, strawberry shrub, Aperol, rosé wine, and a little bit of seltzer.
Oh, this is so great.
Refreshing. Fresh strawberries. So, yeah.
I could drink that every day.
Yeah, it's really good.
Huh. That is a nice drink.
I don't even taste alcohol, really.
It's a little like
grown-up
juice.
Another sip.
It's delicious. Everyone, where can we get one of these?
At the Bennett.
At the Bennett?
Okay. At 134 West Broadway.
Nice. Amazing. I love that.
It's really, really good. Highly recommend it.
What else? What do you expect the big things will be this summer? Are you tired of rosé yet?
I'm never tired of rosé. I think a few people are, it seems like, but it's just so good and it goes down easy. I would love to check out those white strawberries that you found. People are really into a lot of pineapple juice I get requests for, and also spicy drinks right now, always, the past couple
spicy
years.
Spicy drinks.
Yep.
Tell us more.
Spicy tequila. That's what people want.
Spicy tequila.
We have a cool one on the menu at the Bennett, which is we spice pineapple juice with Aleppo pepper and red chili, lime, mezcal, and reposado tequila, which is a really cool balance. But jalapenos we use, all kinds of chili. There's an ancho chili liqueur, which is pretty new, just to like kind of capitalize on what people are looking for.
We had Berta Gonzalez on the show a few weeks ago to talk about her tequila brand. And it really sounds like tequila is having a huge moment.
Yeah, people love agave and mezcal too. Like all kinds of people that you wouldn't always expect are looking for mezcal, which is really fun for us.
Is it a total bummer for you when someone sits down and orders a glass of wine?
Not really.
Or beer.
Once in a while, I will say that once in a while you appreciate that break in service of like, I can get that for you in 3 seconds. But I think over the years, it's part of being a good bartender too, is like being invested in what people drink, but not to the point that it bums you out, you know?
Because it's like a chef when somebody orders the hamburger.
Yeah.
Versus whatever the special is.
But if you have a hamburger, you should stand behind it, and I'm happy with everything we serve, so.
So when do you have time to sort of exercise the creative part of what you do?
That is a challenge, for sure. Because a big part of my job, I would say, is being creative, and it's hard to have that mental space sometimes when you're just really busy or, you know, it's bars full of, you know, young people and they want to travel and sometimes they go out without a lot of notice or things happen. We have a great staff that for the most part has been there for a long time, but, you know, little things always happen. And part of my job, the other half, is kind of putting out those fires. So it's definitely a balance of finding time to actually be away from the bar, go out other places, see what people are doing, and just think about what are we missing on this menu or what can we do next?
Mm-hmm. And then one thing that I find really hard about the restaurant industry, and it's got to be super tough as a bartender, is the hours. So you are usually somewhere dark for hours at night. Maybe you get home at 2 or 3 or, I don't know, even later than that. How do you deal with sort of those hours and having maybe a life that's totally different from your friends and your family?
Yeah, that's hard because, like, you know, if you're my family, for instance, it's like Saturday and Sunday. That's the only days they're off. And those are the days we're busy, or holidays are very, very busy. Sometimes you can get like actual Christmas off, but not too much around it. So, I mean, there's no perfect answer to it. I do try to get home on the early side if I know I have things to do the next day, because I definitely have like burned myself out working super late, trying to get up at 10 to like do the business side of things. And we always like, we're very careful about the schedule and when people are working and who's doing what.
Mm-hmm. So what are you up to this summer?
This summer I'm going to Charleston for BevCon, which cool. I have been to Charleston a couple of times. I love it.
Such a great city, right?
Yeah. Tales of the Cocktail in July in New Orleans. So that's going to be warm and exciting. And then trying to figure out a vacation, but no plans yet.
I've never been to Tales of the Cocktail, but I've heard about it. It sounds insane.
It is insane.
Like everyone in your world just descends on New Orleans.
To a city that serves drinks 24 hours a day.
That's true. I heard a really great talk on all the sort of signature New Orleans drinks when I was down there last summer for a conference. And what is that one? The shark drink? What do you know the drink? There's this famous place, and they put a plastic shark.
Oh, I've seen the photos of it.
The shark attack.
Yeah,
right.
I've seen it on Instagram. Of course.
Did you, Gilly? Did you have one?
Yeah.
You did not. You drank a shark attack?
I drank all of the New Orleans things.
Wow.
The tall plastic.
But it was amazing. It's like a blue drink, and then they have a shark that is filled with a red liqueur, and they put the shark in your drink and squeeze it in so it looks like an actual, well, I mean, it doesn't look like an actual shark attack. They're replicating a shark attack in a frozen beverage.
But they pretty also close, like yeah. aggressively, like they make it look like the shark is attacking the drink. They like pound it into it.
But I think the poor bartenders have to sort of get involved in the act and scream shark attack and ring a bell and do all these things. And I think the level of interest on the bartender's part ranges from like complete blasé to super duper into it.
Oh, definitely. Like when you had to sing happy birthday at Friendly's and you're like, oh man, again.
So you're not singing happy birthday in any of your bars to the guests?
Personally, I don't think anyone wants to hear me sing happy birthday, but luckily in bartending, there's a lot of ex-musical theater folks, so they're more than happy to take over.
This drink is great. You need some more, Claudia. I can keep reaching for this instead of the water, which might not be the best idea.
I've got a long day ahead of me.
So, Megan, we have a little speed round for you. Shaken or stirred?
Right down the middle, but mostly stirred.
Coffee or tea?
Coffee all the time.
What's in your fridge?
Always eggs, vermouth, and usually some kind of like leftover fried rice to put the egg on the next day.
Do you cook?
I'm a really good breakfast person. At night, I have hard time with the timing. I make drinks really fast, and getting like a steak and rice and a vegetable together is too hard.
What are you currently reading?
Right now, I'm reading mostly a lot of magazines that have piled up. New York, The New Yorker, got the new Cherry Bomb, of course. Not too many books right now.
Okay. Where would you like to travel to next?
I really want to go to Australia.
Oh, nice. Yeah, we want to go there,
summer too. Summer vacation, yeah. Although it's winter there right now.
Yeah, you just need to get, like, you need at least 2 solid weeks to be able to go to Australia,
I think.
It's
a long trip, mm-hmm. Yeah. It's crazy.
I've been to Sydney. It's so great there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Megan, tell us all your bars again, because there are so many, so everybody can go visit when they're in New York.
All right. So you can visit me at the baby of the group, Rain's Law Room on West 17th Street, Rain's Law Room at the William Hotel on 39th Street, Dear Irving on Irving Place, and our new baby, The Bennett, on West Broadway.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much. Thank you for the drink. It's fantastic. And I hope we get to see you again.
Yeah. Thanks, ladies.
Cheers. We'll be right back with our next guest.
Today's episode is brought to you by Prince Street, Dean and DeLuca's monthly podcast dedicated to the delicious and infinite connections between people and food. Each new Prince Street podcast features special guests, field reports, and meals from around the world. Editor-in-Chief Howie Kahn hosts the show, featuring segments from correspondents such as Griffin Dunn, Jay McInerney, Eden Grinchpan, and Sierra Tishkart. Download Prince Street on iTunes and online at livefromprincestreet.com. Prince Street, a fresh new podcast with a culinary heart. New York City loves bagels, as do I. Our next guest rose above the doughy throngs to create one of the most popular bagels in the city at Black Seed Bagel. Diana Dowhong, who was raised in a Laotian and Thai household and studied at the French Culinary Institute, may not have known her culinary path would lead to a Canadian baked good, but she has become one of the most respected names in the New York baking scene thanks to her Montreal-inspired bagels. Diana, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thanks for having me. Very excited.
I actually wanted to have you in the first season, but things didn't work out. But I'm so glad you're here.
I'm here
because
now.
I love bagels.
Damn, I should have brought some.
No, it's okay. It's probably not good for our waistlines. But I do remember when Black Seed first opened, going there and being given two bagels by Matt Drucker, who was doing like a story there. And I took them back to my office, and the two bagels just disappeared. I looked down, and they were gone. And I just like scarfed them down. They were so good. But let's go back a little bit, because your parents immigrated to the States. And I always wonder how people end up where they are. Your parents ended up in Florida.
Right.
Did you have relatives here?
No. So basically how my family came over, we were sponsored, because in the early 80s, it was a very easy kind of process. You didn't have to go through as much stuff as you do now, obviously. But we got sponsored by a random Christian coalition because they were in a refugee camp. And we actually ended up in Ohio first. We were in Ohio for about 5 years. And there's, you know, the typical immigrant story. There's factory work in Florida, and that's just kind of how they migrated that way.
So, were you born here? Or you?
Yeah, I was the only one in my whole entire family born in Ohio out of all places. I know everybody else has such an amazing story. My brother is born in Thailand, and everybody's like, oh, where were you born? I'm like, Ohio.
It's okay. There's some good people I know born in Ohio. So what was your childhood growing up? Because I think in Asian families, you know, it's a lot of life revolves around food and cooking. Like, we didn't really eat out much as a family. Yeah. My mom was just always cooking.
Yeah. I mean, it's similar story. You know, I think the great thing about having a first generation kind of lifestyle is that, you know, my mom always cooked. Like, she'd make her own stock. At the time, I didn't know it was stock. I was just like, why are there bones in boiling water? I don't understand. You know, I want Pizza Hut, or I want American food. And I was such a brat then, but no, it's very true. Even though she had three jobs, she'd always make sure she would make curries from scratch. Just the most amazing Thai food. And now, after looking at it, I was like, man, I wish I would have. I mean, she would definitely force me to do. I was like her prep cook, you know, her little sous chef. And she would, even though at the time I didn't understand it, I now doing what I do, I am so grateful that she forced me to sit down and, you know, do all these traditional Thai foods is amazing.
So being a chef wasn't something that you kind of aspired to as you went to college.
Right.
And then you eventually moved to New York and started working in advertising.
Right.
What kind of made you, you know, take that turn in your career?
Yeah, so I was in advertising for about 4 years doing strategy. I worked with a lot of great people. I'm still friends with a lot of people in the industry. But it definitely was one of those things where I'm like, all right, I'm into it for 4 years. It's kind of whether I take that next step with advertising or do I really do something I'm passionate about. You know, like I said, I met a lot of great people, but at the end of the day, it was definitely still that typical 9 to 5, sit down and punch out a bunch of emails. And I'm definitely more of a hands-on person where, you know, I like to craft. I like to do things with my hands. And you know, at the end of the day, I wasn't really happy with advertising. So I was just like, all right, let's just see what's out there. So I went back to serving just to figure out, you know, in the interim what I should do. And I really thought about my passions in general. And I was like, you know what, I'm going to try culinary school and see how it goes from there. Forgetting about the huge debt that culinary school gives you. But I'm really glad I did do it, though. And in hindsight, I just couldn't even imagine if I was still in advertising kind of thing.
So you actually studied pastry at French Culinary
right.
Institute. How long is that program?
There's a bunch of different programs. At French Culinary, I just did the shorter program, the night program, which is about 9 months. Like I said, it's definitely expensive, and when people ask me about it, I'm like, don't do it. But when I think about it, it definitely gave me enough skill set and confidence to really grow and adapt in the culinary scene.
Is that something you like to do, mentor, you know, people who work for you who maybe haven't gone to culinary school?
Absolutely. I tell people all the time, that's my favorite thing. Yeah, it's great to create and, you know, give the public something new. But at the end of the day, the most enjoyment I get is when one of the new bakers comes up and is just like, man, I never actually thought I could do this. And now that I'm doing it, I'm totally inspired and I'm going to pursue it as a career. And especially nowadays with the economy so well, there's less and less, I don't want to call highbrow chefs, but you know what I mean? When the economy's good, you can get a job blogging about food. You can get a job being an Instagram food person. So you are getting, I don't want to say less, it's not less educated, but less educated in the culinary field, especially with a bagel shop. So I think inspiring people that didn't necessarily have an aspiration to go towards the culinary world is my all-time favorite thing, is to inspire people to do this.
I mean, a lot of pastry is kind of like a bit like chemistry, like science and math. Mm-hmm. But there's also that side where you kind of have to like feel out things, because it is also like, especially with bread, it's kind of like a living thing. Mm-hmm. Do you have any tricks for us? Because I tried to make bagels at home once and I ended up burning my arm.
Oh, I have several burns on my arm, so that's just going to happen. But like I said, you nailed it on the head, especially specifically your bread. As much as you follow a recipe, it's going to be super hot out. It's going to be humid. The water temperature might be different. So I think just the more you practice it and the more you do it, getting that natural baker's feel, as I like to call it, will just come to you. Because that's the thing, it's, you could follow the recipe exactly, have the same exact water temperature, but like I said, it could be raining outside, and that really does affect the moisture of the dough.
So tell us a little bit about Black Seed. Mm-hmm. You guys have kind of expanding, like, hotcakes. You have the original location's in Soho, mm-hmm. on Elizabeth Street. Mm-hmm. Then you have Brookfield Place, and then you just took over Vesuvio's. Well, it's not... It's been open for a while, but...
Di Roberta's.
Yeah. Okay. What did taking over that space allow you guys to do? Because it is a much bigger facility.
Yeah, it's huge. I feel so grateful when Matt and Noah, the other two partners, showed me the space while it was under construction. I was like, are you kidding me? Are you serious? This is where I get a cook? Because, you know, obviously you don't see the basement area, but the basement area is just as big as the upstairs, and... just to have that space in New York City alone allows you to do so much more. You know, in the beginning, Matt and Noah had this vision where it was just going to be very much, you know, like Rust and Daughters, just appetizing foods. They didn't even want egg and cheese in the beginning. They just really wanted to be fish-based and like cream cheese-based things. However, we're in New York City. Everybody wants egg and cheese when they're hungover, right? So, you know, learning from that experience with First Avenue, we definitely expanded the line with adding a griddle and a stovetop, and also a way bigger oven. The oven we have at First Avenue can do pretty much triple the amount that our Soho location can do.
Are you guys wholesaling at all?
We did try to start doing that, but I think the difficult thing that people don't understand about wholesale, specifically with bread, is people expect you to sell it for a nickel when they forget about all the labor, you know, especially if you're using great flour like King Arthur. All those things play into how much you're selling it for. So we are going to eventually go back into it, but right now we're kind of just slowing our role, and we're just so busy with just things in store and special events that we really want to focus on keeping the product and the quality super good before we, you know, become a huge giant in every supermarket. That's not our goal. Our goal is to create a really good bagel.
So explain to us the difference between a Montreal-style bagel and, like, the traditional bagel, New York-style bagel.
Yeah, so I think the biggest difference is definitely using a wood oven. You know, with Black Seed in particular, Matt will find this very important to say, but we like to say we're a hybrid. It's kind of like, can you really call champagne if it's not made in Champagne, right? So with us, we kind of use more of a New York style dough. It's not as dense as a Montreal bagel. But the main difference is, Black Seed aside, is the size. Montreal has a smaller size, a little bit more dense. New York bagel is obviously a little bit fatter, a little fluffier, barely has a hole in it sometimes. At least that's what we come to know it as. And there's also honey in the Montreal bagel. And instead of using malt or lye to boil it in, you use honey instead. And, you know, like I said, with Black Sea, we kind of took both versions and meshed it into the perfect bagel. So
it's really good. I'm a big fan of bagels, and I grew up on them and lived in New York.
Of course.
I do, especially when, like, it's in a perfect sandwich with, like, you guys make, like, this beet-cured lox.
Yeah.
It's so good.
Yeah.
You must love the Montreal bagels, because I grew up eating those bagels. They're basically, like, so
pillows.
Big and fluffy.
Right.
You could rest your head on it.
It's pretty much like a roll with a little, like, belly button in it.
That's why, Claudia, when you were like, I am obsessed with bagels, I was like, that is the last food I envisioned you eating. But I can see the appeal of the Montreal bagel. It's a more sophisticated product.
Absolutely. With sandwiches, I like kind of the perfect ratio of things. I hate when you get a burger and it's all brioche bun and such a little patty. I think it needs to be all like that perfect. Enough vegetables, enough meat, you know, and I think that's a good thing about our bagels in particular. You don't get all dough, you know.
So you and I spoke last year at the Taste Talks conference.
It was fun.
Remember that? We had a good time. You talked a lot about being meditative in the kitchen.
Yeah.
Can you riff on that a little bit for us?
Yeah. I grew up in an extremely Orthodox Buddhist household. My dad actually retired and went back to Thailand to become a monk. But I think specifically more with bakers. It's the same with cooking, too, but with cooking it's a little bit more like an instant gratification and less repetitive. But with baking in particular, you know, you are doing that same motion over and over. You are making that one cupcake, cookie, bagel on a hourly basis. You're not, like, switching to sautéing something. So you definitely get into that meditative zone where you don't even realize it, but you're not even necessarily thinking about anything. And that's kind of the key of meditation, is you're not occupying your brain with something that, you know, you're living in that moment. So when you're baking, specifically with bread, you are focusing on that piece of bread, where it allows you to almost forget any kind of worry outside of that. You know, I just love waking up super early in the morning and having nobody in the restaurant yet and just kind of starting my first batch. And it's and watching the sunrise, especially now since it's coming up at like 5 a.m., it's great.
Do you meditate at home?
I try to. It's definitely getting harder with the schedule, but I try to do at least 5 minutes in the morning before I head out. I mean, living in the city, you know, the first thing you do is you face the public, even if you want to or not, and I think it's a super important part to be balanced.
Because you do have a super peaceful aura.
Oh, thanks.
I don't know if people tell you that, but you really do give that off.
People always say that, are you from California? And I'm assuming it's the same thing.
You're assuming it's a compliment?
Yeah.
last thing I want to ask, the rainbow bagel. And Gilly's going to laugh. I still haven't eaten a rainbow bagel, but is Mile End ever going to do a rainbow bagel?
No, don't
tell Noah I asked that question.
Yeah, no. I mean, that's far. We don't even have a sweet bagel. We don't even do a cinnamon raisin bagel, you know.
No funfetti frosting?
Oh, God. I wish I could curse on this thing right now.
You can curse. All right, Dave, our engineer, is saying, go ahead.
I mean, my thing is, I can't imagine what it comes out like after you put it in, you know. That's like my thing. I'm just like, I can't. Yeah, not that I'm like, I appreciate organic foods and I try to eat pretty healthy myself. So just the thought of the coloring they have to use to do that. Yeah, I know.
Some of them are like neon.
Right. That's what's, I mean, it's cool. Like, I'm not going to knock on them. Like, that bagel shop's been around forever. I used to live in Williamsburg. Used to go there all the time. You know, they got their thing. But as far as Black Sea goes, we definitely try to keep it classy and OG, you know. Not that I'm saying.
Keeping it classy. I love that.
Yeah.
Is there anything new that you guys are working on that we should look out for?
I mean, at this time, we're just really trying to keep up with the business. You know, it's been great. We are working on expanding our catering program. You know, we're doing like a party bagel, which is a ginormous bagel, like the size of, maybe I'll bring you one. Maybe that's for your birthday.
party it's coming bagel. Up.
It's amazing. It's huge. It's about like 12 inches in diameter.
Wow.
And it's just one big sandwich bagel that we divide up into 12.
Oh, but, my God. I love that. I love the name of the party bagel.
Yeah, it's party bagel. But no, we're just trying to, you know, just keep the bagels as, you know, I think the hardest part is, obviously, I'm not the only one baking the bagels, so keeping the quality up to par is definitely our biggest focus. But, you know, we're definitely going to expand some pastries, kind of keep up with the season. So,
What kind of stuff do you guys do in your pastries?
Right now, speaking of Rainbow Bays, we we do rainbow cookies just because, you know, since we're in an Italian, old Italian shop, right. It's kind of paying homage to them. Super classic stuff, you know, oatmeal chocolate chip. I think the thing with the bagel shop is people aren't going there to get a cronut or a fancy pastry. They want their classics, you know, and anytime we kind of do go out of that realm of something more comforting, it doesn't necessarily sell because, like I said, people want what's nostalgic to them, especially at a bagel shop. So
true.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for being on the show.
We're gonna
do a little speed round with you right now.
Cool.
Coffee or tea?
Coffee for sure.
How do you take it?
With a little honey and milk.
Oh, honey.
Yeah.
What's in your fridge right now?
Hot sauce, avocado, kimchi, and kale. I know it's weird. Oh, and champagne. Yeah, you gotta have them all.
How do you like your eggs?
Over easy.
What's the one thing you'd never eat?
Oh man, I don't know if I can answer it. I guess anything that comes out of the other end of an animal, because that is in some native plant. I mean, but I probably would try that too. I'm Thai. We're okay, weird. We eat everything.
Asians eat everything.
Yeah, it's so true.
What's your favorite kitchen tool?
Oh man, probably a really small my small utility knife. I used to get made fun of on the line for it because I would work with these macho guys with like pen, but I would just kill it on the line with it. So,
what's your go-to snack?
Oh man. Probably goldfish. I love goldfish.
Oh, for a second I was picturing an actual goldfish. I was like, wow, you really will eat anything. No. Where do you want to travel to next?
Oh, man. That's a hard one. I think Fiji. I've been really wanting to go to Fiji super bad, especially with the tropical.
Sounds amazing.
Yeah. You guys want to go now?
Yeah, let's go. Then we'll go to Australia.
I think she's the first one to say Fiji.
Oh nice.
Score. Well, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
I'll definitely stop by the shop and gorge on bagels soon.
Yeah, you have to come back. I'm sure there's a lot more we could talk about meditation and baked goods. And, you know, we didn't even touch into your heritage and the foods you grew up eating. And so come back and let's talk about that again one day. So we will be right back
with Mimi Sheraton.
Were you into avocado toast before any of your friends? Do you know how to whip up some cashew cream? And do you make your own almond milk? If so, you're our kind of person, and you might be interested in the classes at the Natural Gourmet Institute for Health and Culinary Arts, located in the heart of Manhattan. Founded in 1977, NGI is the first culinary school dedicated to healthy cooking to be accredited nationally. Their professional chef's training program is offered full and part-time, and several of our favorite chefs are alumni, including Dirt Candy's Amanda Cohen, Alyssa Wagner of Dimes, and Chloe Coscarelli of By Chloe. Visit the NGI website to learn how you can transform your life and your career.
Hi, this is Mimi Sheraton. I'm the author of 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die. Here's one to get you started. Tasmanian Leatherwood Honey. The color of molten gold, this heavily perfumed and elegant honey is derived from the nectar of the starry white blossoms of 350-year-old leatherwood trees. Canny bees gather the nectar in the humid rainforest of Tasmania, the only place on earth where the leatherwood tree grows. The unblended honey that results has a unique smoked candy flavor with a hint of spicy bitterness and a slightly overripe aroma like that of some aged cheeses. Just as with those cheeses, it may take a little getting used to, but is well worth the effort. Sampled by the spoonful, drizzled onto yogurt or vanilla ice cream, or stirred into tea or warm milk, or even spread over hot buttered English muffins, scones, or flaky croissant, leatherwood honey is all sweetness and engaging complexity. After you fall in love with the sophisticated honey, you'll want to get behind the effort to protect the endangered leatherwood trees. Along with neighboring eucalyptus trees, they are the frequent victims of the lumber industry. Saving the leatherwood forest has important benefits beyond the obvious pleasures of the honey. Also at stake is the livelihood of the beekeepers, whose hives are already declining in number, and the local farmers who depend on busy bees to cross-pollinate their crops.
Save the planet, guys. Buy leatherwood honey in your local store.
Don't you want to get it now?
I do.
Yeah.
It's painted such a pretty picture of our planet.
You can find it online.
So thanks, Mimi. Be sure to pick up her book, 1,000 Foods to Eat Before You Die, at your favorite indie bookstore.
Thank you to our sponsors for supporting Radio Cherry Bomb. Natural Gourmet Institute for Health and Culinary Arts. Start your journey to become a natural food chef today by visiting ngihca.edu.
Prince Street, a fresh podcast with a culinary heart. For more, visit livefromprincestreet.com or download the Prince Street podcast from iTunes.
Baldor Specialty Foods curates and delivers the best and freshest food in the world to the restaurant and hospitality industries. Learn what Baldor can do for your business today at baldorfood.com.
Thank you for listening, everyone.
You're the bomb.
And I'm Cherry Bomb's summer intern. I'm a student at the University of Pennsylvania, where I lead Pen Appetit, an entirely student-produced food magazine. Radio Cherry Bomb is a joint production of Cherry Bomb Magazine and the Heritage Radio Network. To subscribe or learn more about the magazine, visit cherrybomb.com. You know who I think is the bomb? Ellen Yin, the co-owner of High Street Hospitality. She transformed the Philadelphia dining scene when she opened the restaurant Fork nearly 20 years ago, and she's still killing it. High Street on Market, Fork Sister Cafe, is my favorite place to eat in Philly because of its unique fermented flavors and insanely delicious bread. Its New York outpost, High Street on Hudson, was just named one of Food & Wine's 10 best restaurants in America. She's the bomb.